session number 6612, Reel 2.
Colonel Paul Walker, Reel 2. I presume that this regimental brothel was regularly inspected.
You are quite right. The brothel, which I don't like calling it a regimental brothel, more a military brothel, this was inspected frequently by the medical authorities to see that none of the women would pass on any disease, and the troops were strictly instructed that if the urge came upon them, they would be, and anything, they were caught in a non-regulation brothel or misbehaving with any other young ladies, they were in for trouble. But if they went to the regimental brothel to satisfy their urges, they were in the clear, and the military police who patrolled the brothel area would not take any action against them. In addition to these sort of activities, we had the usual civilian entertainments, and on the whole, the troops liked being in Alexandria, and their relations with the cosmopolitan population, for they're not only Egyptians, but there were many Greeks and Italians living in Alexandria. Their relationship with the civilians was very good, and on the whole, the troops were very happy. Of course, you did occasionally get some young man homesick for the girl he'd left behind him, but on the whole, as far as I knew, and we were kept in very close touch with the morale of the troops, Alexandria was a happy station.
So you had, you didn't have much trouble with crime?
No, practically not. No, practically no crime at all.
You mentioned that they had the usual civilian entertainments available. Now, what were these?
Well, Alexandria was a very Europeanized city, and there were plenty of cinemas, dance halls, and for the officers, polo and racing, and there was a very large expatriate British population in Alexandria, chiefly from cotton merchants and government officials, because a lot of the Egyptian civil service were manned by British officers. So there was a lot of entertainment, not only of the troops, but of officers, by other British people. And as I said before, it was a happy station, and there was no military, no crime whatsoever. The only crime that one was, I used to have up before me, were slight military misdemeanors, like having dirty boots or unpolished buttons, that sort of thing. But on the whole, the battalion was an extremely happy and well-behaved one.
If I can ask you about your political expectations, when did you first become aware of the fact that there might be a war in the near future?
When we first arrived in Egypt, the great atmosphere there was the memories of the Abyssinian War. I would happen to be going through the Suez Canal when this war was being started, on my way to a post in India, and the Suez Canal was crowded with Italian troop ships, and the Egyptians were terrified that they would also be invaded by the Italians. I remember one rather amusing incident. On the banks of the Suez Canal were a small party of British soldiers, and the Italian soldiers on their troop ship, in order to show their contempt for the British started to urinate over the side of the boat. And one of the British soldiers in the party said, shouted out, "It's all right, mate, you can show it now, but when you get out there, you won't keep it for long." Right, stop.
Had this tension relaxed by 1937 when you were posted to Alexandria?
When we arrived in Alexandria, there was at the back of our minds the possibility of a big war. The Rome-Berlin axis had just been inaugurated between Hitler and Mussolini, and I think the powers that be were very conscious of the threat of war. What we thought would happen would be an Italian attack from Libya, which was full of Italian troops, on the Suez Canal to cut our empire lifeline to India. And there were frequent military exercises from the troops in Cairo, the British garrison of Cairo, armoured troops going into the desert with a view to training against a possible Italian threat from Libya. We ourselves in Alexandria were not so much militarily concerned with this because we knew well that our job was initially to protect the naval base in Alexandria.
What sort of tactics did you think the Italians might use if they made this attack?
Well, the threat, as far as we knew then, was what in those days we thought was a conventional threat. We thought that the Italians would use infantry, camel corps, etc., possibly with a few armoured cars. But we had no idea then, and didn't until 1939, of the blitzkrieg tactics which might be employed. So our training envisaged taking up defensive positions against infantry attacks and then, of course, counter-attacking when they attacked. And we had no conception of the tactics that were eventually employed by the Axis against us.
Did you have any fear that there might be an attack by the Italian Air Force?
Yes, we knew that we were very vulnerable to air attack. At that time, in Great Britain, the whole of the army thinking, the whole of the political thinking, was fear of a bombing attack. And the whole of our politics were based on the terrible destruction that would ensue from a German mass attack on our cities. We in Alexandria expected the same to happen. We knew that the Suez Canal was very vulnerable to bombing, and while we were stationed there, the United Kingdom government sent out an anti-aircraft brigade to Abu Kir in defense of the canal and Alexandria.
Now, if we can move on to Palestine in 1938, did your commitment to Palestine come as a surprise to you?
Yes, it came as a great surprise, because after the Munich crisis, we had put the fear of war right at the back of our minds, and the ordinary peacetime life of Alexandria, which was very amusing and rather gay, carried on. Nobody thought of the possibility of war, and the trouble in Palestine did not impinge very much on us until suddenly one Sunday, stop.
You say that the battalion was aware that there was trouble going on in Palestine. Did the members of the battalion favour one side or the other?
No, the members of the battalion were completely indifferent. Like Kipling's British soldiers, they looked on the Arabs and the Jews as lesser breeds without the law, and they really were not in the slightest bit interested in the causes behind the trouble there. They were all desperately keen to have a go, because all soldiers want to go into action. And we were very envious of our fellow British soldiers who were having a bit of active service in Palestine.
When you received orders to go to Palestine, what did you have to do to get ready to go?
I received orders to go to Palestine from the Chief of Staff at the headquarters of the British troops in Egypt. And I immediately informed the commanding officer, who happened to be in church, and he whispered to me while the padre was giving his sermon. He said, immediately after church, call together a conference of company commanders, the second in command, and the quartermaster, which I did. And we had this conference, and there was really very little that we had to do. We were a fully equipped battalion at colonial strength. We had about 800 all ranks, and we were not to go on to wartime accounting. We had what weapons were necessary, which were personal weapons, rifles and Lewis guns then. And other than the married soldiers saying goodbye to their families, there was nothing further for us to do except to wait for orders from headquarters in Cairo as to by what means we were to travel to Palestine, because the railway was cut and we should have to go by sea. Eventually, after the delay of a couple of days, we were informed that we were to embark on a small British India boat, which the authorities managed to commandeer, and stop.
How was the battalion organised?
We were organised on the establishment of a colonial duty battalion, which consisted of four rifle companies and battalion headquarters. Battalion headquarters consisted of the drums, the corps of drums, who were to be stretcher bearers in action, a light machine gun platoon in trucks, which were to give anti-aircraft protection, the medical officer and his orderlies. Right, stop. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any anti-tank weapons or other heavy weapons?
No, the anti-tank weapons consisted of a guardsman waving a green flag and pushing a bicycle. Mortars were envisaged but had not been issued to the army, and our armament consisted entirely of personal weapons and Lewis guns.
Now, I know you'd done a fair bit of tactical training in Egypt. Had the battalion done any internal security training?
We'd done no internal security training on the ground, but we had been given a list of vulnerable points which, in the event of war, we had to occupy and guard. But otherwise, we had no internal security training, because being in Egypt, we were foreign troops, and the British government wanted to take great care that we were in no way involved in Egyptian politics, such as backing up the police or doing the same sort of duties that a British battalion had to do in India.
Did anything of significance happen on your voyage to Palestine?
No, our voyage was completely uneventful. The only thing I would like to say was the very moving experience that we had when we left the harbour of Alexandria, which was crowded with battleships of the Royal Navy, with whom, as I said before, we'd had a very close liaison. And as soon as the crews realised that it was the Third Coldstream were in this boat, in this ship, they all mustered on deck and quite spontaneously cheered us from ship to ship. And as we passed down the line of anchored battleships, this was so moving that it almost brought tears to one's eyes. When we arrived at Haifa, we found the whole place asleep. We'd been expecting to be sniped at, but there was nothing like that at all. We went ashore. I remember I went ashore followed by my batman, who I made load his rifle and be on the alert to take on anybody that threw a bomb at me or shot at me. But the thing was absolutely peaceful. The only drama we had, which was quite a minor one, was we had a small detachment of gunners on board, and they were very upset because orders had been received that they were to land and their guns would be sent forward separately to the base where they were going. And as it was a tradition of the Royal Artillery never to be separated from their guns, they came to me as ship's adjutant and asked me what I thought about it. I told them that I quite agreed with their tradition, but the orders were that they should disembark their soldiers separately and that they'd better do that.
How did you move the battalion out of Haifa once you landed it?
We went up to Sarafan camp by road in RASC lorries, which were waiting for us in the docks. Our battalion transport, that is 1,500 weight trucks and 1,300 weight lorries, had proceeded by road under their own steam across the Sinai Peninsula and joined us after we'd got to Sarafand.
What scale of transport did you have?
I can't remember the exact scale, but offhand, we had about a dozen 1,500 weight trucks. We had each company had its own 1,500 weight truck for its company baggage and greatcoats and packs. The big packs that the soldier normally carried on his back were usually carried in a truck, and we had about a dozen 1,300 weight lorries, which were for carrying things like rations and the battalion baggage.
Now, you say in your narrative that when you got Sarafand, your commanding officer was sent off to Jerusalem to get his orders, and you had to use the drummers to protect the camp. What sort of position did you put them into?
Well, I only got my orders to arrange protection as it was getting dusk, and as there was no time to organise companies into a protecting force, I thought the quickest thing to do was to take the troops, which I had actually under my own hands, which was the corps of drums, consisting of about 30 drummers, and use them as a protective platoon. And in the dusk, I very quickly appreciated the ground, and I saw that the key to the camp, which was then under construction, it was being built, and the huts were only half erected, was a high sand mound in the middle of the camp, and I thought, well, if we hold the high ground, if we are attacked, which I think was extremely unlikely that we would be, that was the key position. So I told my drummers to occupy this mound. The only potential danger was from, again, which we'd been warned about, were the possibility of an Arab creeping up in the dark and sniping at us. But luckily this never materialised.
You said the camp was only half constructed. What could the troops do to make themselves comfortable for the overnight stay?
Well, we were very lucky because the weather was warm and the sand was soft, and the troops just lay down as close to the huts which were under construction as they could, and went to sleep on the ground. Our feeding arrangements, by that time our transport had joined up with us, and we had the cookers and the rations, which were the same scale of rations which we'd been used to in England or on training in the desert, were cooked and sent round to the companies in heat-proof containers and then dished out to the soldiers individually, who filled their mess tins and ate their evening meal from their mess tins.
What about water?
I think, as far as I can remember, that there was a tap water point in the Sarafan camp. But otherwise, whenever we were on operations in Palestine, we depended on the battalion water cart, which was a water bowser carried on a 1,500 weight truck.
When you were away from piped water, what was the sort of standard issue for a day?
I cannot remember, but I think it was something like a couple of gallons a day. But I don't honestly remember.
What arrangements were made for the officers for their overnight accommodation in this camp?
Well, the officers had what we used to call valises, which consisted of a bedroll, blankets, and a canvas covering. And our batmen laid those out either on the sand or in a half-completed hut. The company officers slept in their company lines with the soldiers, and at battalion headquarters, of which I was a member, we slept together.
What did you do about food?
For the officers, we fed exactly the same as the men. We had a very efficient mess sergeant who used to go out and scrounge or buy additional food locally, if we were in an army camp, in the Nafi or in the bazaar, and that supplemented our rations. But normally speaking, throughout the operations, we fed exactly the same as the men. And the tradition was that the officers always queued up last in the queue to draw their food. So the men had first go.
It was a matter of noblesse oblige.
Yes, exactly. Rather like if you were in the cavalry, your horse came in front of you.
I think that the next morning you were sent off to Jerusalem. How did you get there?
We went from Sarafan camp in RESC lorries up the road to Jerusalem. And we went to Tel Avera barracks, which was then occupied by the Black Watch, where we met the commanding officer and the company commanders, who had reconnoitred the old city of Jerusalem the day before, and we received our orders for an attack which was to take place the following morning.
And when did the guardsmen get briefed?
The guardsmen were briefed that night by the company commanders. All orders were given out the previous night because we had to start the attack at 4 o'clock the next morning before it got light.
And were you planning to do an attack as if you were going to encounter heavy resistance?
We thought we were going to. A commanding officer told me, because I spent the night with him, and he thought we were going to have very heavy casualties because the attack was completely unorthodox in that we were to cut the old city of Jerusalem, which is a medieval walled city, filled with winding narrow streets. We were to cut that into four quarters by sending companies up streets, and virtually, in tactical terms, we were to carry out a frontal attack on a front of 3 yards, which was the width of a street, to a depth of about 900 yards. And as the commanding officers, our group, had been badly shot up when they were doing their reconnaissance the day before, Jack Whittaker, the commanding officer, anticipated that we should have very heavy resistance from small arms fire as the companies went up these very narrow streets.
Did you have any intelligence reports about the strength of the enemy?
No. The only way we could gauge the strength of the enemy was by our own eyes and ears and the very heavy fire under which the commanding officer's reconnaissance party had come on the previous day. The Palestine British police had been turned out of the old city by the rebels some days before, and so they were unable to tell us what was in the old city. But we had a low-flying aircraft reconnoitering the temple area at the Haram al-Sharif, where the rebels were concentrated, and this aircraft was very badly shot up as it flew over the temple area.